Hello, this is Chris English with At Home This Morning, a magazine programme that we hope will provide you with a window to our world, both in and around our city of Brighton and Hove and further afield, all for both our older listeners and those not so old. In this programme, we'll be hearing from two intrepid men who have just completed a 2,400-mile row across the Pacific Ocean in a tiny craft, and to add to further drama, one of them is registered blind. I'll also be talking to John Baldock, who's General Manager of the Theatre Royal Brighton, about just how you maintain a building that's over 200 years old. And talking about theatre and the arts brings us neatly to the Brighton Hove Arts Council, whose Kate Arms will be telling us about their drama competition. There'll also be news about the next Older People's Festival, with some details of what you'll be able to see and do. And finally, I'll be talking to Michael O'Reilly, who'll be taking a quick break from rehearsals for the starring role of Johnny Castle in the new tour of the classic musical Dirty Dancing, where his character was played in the film by Patrick Swayze. All this to come in this edition of At Home This Morning. But first, let's hear from the two ex-Royal Marines who've just spent 82 days rowing 2,400 miles across the Pacific Ocean. Steve Sparks, who's registered blind, and Mike Dawson. And when we met up at the headquarters of Blind Veterans UK, which is, of course, better known locally as St Dunstan's, I first asked Mike where the idea came from.
It's out in the Coach House pub in Rotten Dean when I bumped into Steve for the first time in 38 years. We met originally 2 weeks before I joined the Marines when he was actually passing out with my brother. And obviously sort of had that connection, got chatting, so found out what had happened to Steve, how he'd lost his sight in the Corps. Basically had been abandoned by the system. And on the back of that, found out what he was doing with blind, what he'd done with blind veterans, and came up with this ridiculous plot to row across the Pacific and make him the first blind person to do that.
And just a throwaway remark, row across the Pacific. How far was it?
The actual distance is 2,400 miles. I believe we rowed 2,568 or something like that, because you don't go in a straight line or as a crow flies in a rowing boat. So, it was a little over 2,500 miles, which took us 82 days, 14 hours and 56 minutes or something like that. Not that we were counting.
Steve, the boat itself, describe the boat.
Well, the boat is 21 foot long. She's 6 foot wide in the middle in the beam. Small cabin at the front and a slightly larger cabin at the back that we used to use, obviously, for sleeping in. And the centre of the boat was just the rowing deck, very small, compact. Within the boundaries of the boat, we had everything. We had all our supplies, our food for the entire trip. We had a water-making plant. Very cosy indeed. She was royal blue in colour, and very streamlined. I like to think of her as my lotus on the water.
Now, of course, Mick just referred to it. You're actually blind.
Yeah, I'm registered blind. I call myself visually impaired. I've just got no macula. I have peripheral vision, so everything's just a shape to me. So when I was on the boat, all I could basically see was a grey sky and grey water for most of the trip, until we got closer to Hawaii when the seas started to go more turquoise. And Mick would start to give me describe the sea state to me, the marine life, the fish and stuff around me. Like, I'll always think of these Dorada fish. They're turquoise, green and
silver
fish, huge things like a metre long. Because at night, when the navigation light was on, when I had the light behind me, I could actually see the shadows when I looked over the side of the boat, all these big fish swimming around us, thinking, oh.
So you had your own view in your head that you could see these things?
Yeah, I just see shapes. So whatever Mick told me, the description, I put into my head, like, you know, to actually see it was just a shape. And I'd literally have to look over the side of the boat, so they would be whizzing around underneath the boat.
I mean, that sounds wonderful if it's a nice, calm day, but it wasn't calm, was it?
No, not most of the time. Sometimes I tried doing that and I never saw the waves, and a wave would come in, and if I caught it wrong, it would go right down my shirt. I'd be, oh no, not again. But one of the hats, obvious, we were soaked with water most of the time we were there. Well, every day, to be fair, you know. It's just drowned in water, basically.
Cold, salty, horrible water.
Yeah, and presumably you didn't have fresh water, certainly to wash with.
We had a water-making system on the boat, desalination, but that was run by solar energy. So although the sun was, the UV light was still charging the batteries, they weren't always fully charged because we never saw the sun for 5 weeks, so they were struggling. So we could produce as much water as we wanted to keep us going, but luxuries like washing every day became quite a rarity, actually. You know, it was only when we realised we could have guaranteed power, we could keep the water plant production going.
What about clean clothes and fresh clothes? Does that exist?
We had X amount of clothing with us, but again, we were restricted to space. You know, there's only so much space in the cabin. You know, and to be fair, when the two of us were in there, with what bags we had, which was basically one bag, you know, it was quite tight. There wasn't a lot of room, trust me. So you were very restricted to what you could take.
Okay, Mick, what about food and things like that?
Basically, the boat's totally self-sufficient. Steve mentioned the solar power. That gives us all the energy for the batteries, you know, from navigation equipment to satellite communications to the navigation light. And also with the food, we were totally self-sufficient. We went with the food that we needed and we came back in with four meals left. So we timed it just right.
Mm. And what kind of food did you eat?
Boil in a bag. Expedition foods were absolutely superb, I've got to say. It was one of the highlights. Every meal was a highlight anyway in a rowing boat, but the food was excellent. The variety, it's a big difference from when we was in the Marines and the rations we got them. It's fuel. It's really important. If you're not getting fueled, you can't row 24 hours a day, or 12 hours a day each. The boat, it's all about going and getting in, totally self-sufficient.
And how did you work out who was going to row when?
Two on, two off, round the clock. And we have one shift of 2 1-hour shifts so that we never rowed the same routine. You didn't get the graveyard shift at 2 o'clock in the morning the same day. So we just did that, and we did it religiously. It was, you may look at the people who followed us may see days when we didn't do many miles. They're usually the days when we were working the hardest and the conditions were against us. We were competitive, former Royal Marines. We wanted to win that race, and we were rowing as hard as we could.
Just the thought of rowing that distance, did you have any idea what it was going to be like?
I was under no illusions from day one. You know, as soon as we set off from Monterey Bay, you know, the sea was against us. I thought, this is going to be a long, long trip. And yes, it was definitely, definitely difficult. And I was under no illusions. Yeah, it's always going to be difficult from day one. And it certainly was.
And the weather?
I think we were particularly unlucky with the weather, because I was certainly led to believe it was going to be sunny. I was going to see all this marine life, and oh, it was going to be an amazing trip. Literally, for 5 weeks, we never saw the sun. Just horrendous waves, soaked, cold. Continually cold, yeah. Living in wet clothes. I mean, you went back to, well, how much clothing did we have? Well, I think I had 5 shirts, but they were all saturated. My sleeping bag was so wet in the end, I just rolled it up and put it in a poly bag and used it as a pillow. It was that bad. Yeah, so, no, it wasn't pleasant. But towards the end, it picked up. Had a few days of real good weather. The sea started to look shiny and stuff.
And then a hurricane.
And Hurricane Lane decided to turn up and ruin the party. And he'd only just told me we'd probably be in with him 3 days. And then he had to tell me, we've got a slight problem. There's a hurricane coming our way. How to ruin a party, eh?
and a real hurricane?
Yeah, it's the second hurricane in history to hit Hawaii. It was a Cat 5. Fortunately, it didn't remain a Cat 5 when it hit Hawaii, and Hawaii took the sting out of it. But yeah, it was a bad day at the office for us. In fact, the last 3 or 4 days getting in, despite the day when it hit us, we were hit by the outer ring hitters, the 3 days after it was nightmarish. I think everybody think that it passed and we were just cruising in. We had a right old battle for 4 days.
The seas were just totally disturbed. Yeah. It was just...
And you got thrown overboard.
Yeah, that was in the second week. Just a massive wave hit the boat, and I don't see it coming, do I? It's like, boosh, gone. But I'm tethered, so obviously the lines kept me tight, and good old Bojangles the boat, and she uprighted herself. She only went over halfway, but she levelled herself out. She pulled me back on. So that was an interesting thing. Cold. And I was just laying there thinking lifeboat at one point, because I had water rushing around my head. Like, oh, what's going on? What's going on? And he was in the cabin asleep. And he came out of the cabin, said, "Are you all right, Spike? Are you all right?" I said, "Yeah, yeah, fine, mate." He said, "Are you all right to carry on rowing?" I'm giving it, "Really?"
He actually said, "Yeah." But he meant, "No."
And then he saw that both oars had snapped clean in half. That's how big a wave it hit us. Snapped both our oars. That was a bit of a nightmare for us.
You had spare oars?
We had spare ones, yeah, but they were like, you know, you really didn't expect to lose two oars on the second week of the trip. So that was putting us under pressure from that point on as well.
And were you frightened?
Yeah.
At times or continuously?
Mate, when you're sat on a boat that's 21 foot long and you're just sat there on your own because there's only ever one of us there, and these big waves just come and hit you, because I got unseated quite a few times, like the wave would come over and just sheer force of the wave, I'd end up on the side. You do get frightened because you don't know, especially when you can't see them coming, because you don't know how big the next one's going to be. You know, well, am I going to be hit with one of those whoppers that done the oars? It's, you know, so most times I was there, especially at night, I was thinking, oh God, what am I going to get tonight? So, yeah.
Would you do it again?
Yeah, probably.
So not daunted at all?
For me, it was the reason why we'd done it. It was for the charities. So it was giving back something for me. And it was a worthy challenge. You know, it wasn't, no disrespect to people that do fundraising or anything like that, but it was a major challenge, and I think it was worthy of the money that we're currently seeing coming in from people that want to sponsor us. So, you know, it was good, you know, and we've had a great response, and hopefully it will continue.
And the charities are?
Obviously the UK Blind Veterans, Blind Veterans UK, and the Royal Marines Charity, both very relevant to myself and Steve as former Royal Marines, and Steve, who's a big part of Blind Veterans since, what, 91?
92.
Can people still contribute to the charity, the fundraising?
They certainly can. If I could remember, I would tell you the address, but Steve can, so he's the guy to ask that question to.
It's www.cockleshell-pacific.com, and the website will lead you straight to the donations page. It's straight there. It's quite simple.
Congratulations, and thank you very much.
And thank you to anyone that helps us on this.
Thank everybody that supported us. The donations are fabulous, but anybody who's just followed this and got something out of it or sent us a message, thanks. It's been better than we could have wished for, the support.
Our very own Cockleshell heroes, Mike Dawson and Steve Sparks, who've just returned from their epic 2,400-mile row across the Pacific Ocean. And from rowing, let's move on to Brighton's truly historic Theatre Royal. And when I met up with General Manager John Baldock backstage recently, I first asked him how much he knows about the early history of this 200-year-old building.
Well, the venue's, where are we now, 211 years old. So we've got a fairly good record of it from day one, to be honest. There's an archive that's held by East Sussex Council up at the Keep, and that is fairly thorough. So there's programmes and posters from most productions. I think from the very, 1807, there's perhaps some gaps in the collection, but certainly from around about the 40s, it's full. It's kind of, there's something for everything.
We've been talking to David Fisher about the Hippodrome in the past.
Yeah.
If that does get rebuilt, and it must be a huge question mark because of the amount of money.
Yeah.
How will that affect you?
Difficult to say, really. I mean, it's inevitably going to have an impact on all the venues in the city, you know, not just us. It'll impact the Brighton Centre, it'll impact the Dome as well. I don't know how it will be funded, whether it's going to be a commercial venue or whether it's going to expect subsidy from somewhere. I think it's a great thing. I think it's a beautiful venue. These places are important and need keeping. But I just think there's some really careful thought needs to go into what its programme is going to be. Because having the big musicals that perhaps can't be housed anywhere else in Brighton is all well and good, but there are some years that none of those musicals are touring. You know, as part of ATG, Ambassador Theatre Group, we get those musicals to our bigger venues elsewhere in the country. And, you know, there are years in our programme where they don't happen. So there's gaps in the budget because that big musical isn't touring. So my concern would be that it relies too heavily on those big scale musicals that there aren't enough of, basically.
I was reading earlier today that attendances, audience attendances for plays has gone down,
okay,
although musicals have gone up. That was in the last year. Is that something you've noticed here?
I think you always see a fluctuation. It's very difficult to identify any kind of pattern, to be honest. So much depends on what the play is, who's in the play. Something like No Man's Land, which was here the year before last, I think, Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart, you know, it was 100% capacity. Something more recently, a nice play with a nice cast, was less, you know, it did less. But whether that's because people aren't interested in the title or aren't interested in the people in it, who can say? You know, it's difficult.
How important are the cast?
Oh, important. How important are they? I mean, it helps. It inevitably helps. I mean, it's not a sad state of affairs that's what matters. You can have a really good quality play with a cast of really quality unknowns, but it's a harder sell, absolute harder sell. I think the audiences are more cautious and perhaps less willing to take a risk than they were a few years ago. They're a bit more thrifty, maybe careful what they're going to spend their money on. And so if it's a name they recognise or someone they admire, I think they're more prepared to come along to the theatre to see them.
Of course, musicals in the West End, ticket prices are horrendous. I mean, the latest one, the revamped Victoria Palace, which is the American...
Oh, the Hamilton.
Hamilton.
Yeah.
I mean, ticket prices of £200.
I think it's without sitting and looking, I think those ticket prices always hit the headlines. But most venues, including most of the West End venues, will have entry-level tickets that, you know, they may not be £15, but certainly there'll be tickets available for £30 or £40, which is still a lot of money. But, you know, not every seat in the house is going to be £200. They are going to be the top level sort of tickets. And most theatres operate like that. You know, there will be cheaper tickets available. It might just mean people not sitting dead centre in the stalls, that's all.
Back to the Theatre Royal,
yeah,
an old building, over 200
yeah,
years old. How difficult is it to keep it going?
Phenomenally. It's an expensive building. You know, there are no small jobs. Every maintenance task that gets undertaken escalates. We've recently, we were going to just replace the bay windows at the front of the building. We started the job. It was going to be a 6-week process. We ended up with scaffold up the front of the building for the best part of 7 months, I think, or certainly 6 months, because as they dug deeper, they discovered more and more things that were done kind of 100 years ago that just aren't up to today's standards. So, you know, they've been done as well whilst the work is being undertaken. So it's that proverbial sort of money pot, really. It kind of just grows and grows.
And the future?
It's looking good. Yeah, we've got we're one of the busiest venues within the company of ATG. We have more performances than a lot of other venues. Our audience base is forever growing. We're attracting new people to the theatre. We've got a huge range of programmes of productions that we show. So there's that appeal of something for everybody, from big commercial musicals to lesser known dramas and sort of quality product like that, plus the whole gambit of creative learning and community sort of programme that we offer as well.
So the theatre's going to be here for another 100, 200 years?
I do hope so. I do hope so. Whether it will be recognisable or whether it will, you know, the bits that we know now, whether they'll still be standing and whoever's in charge will be talking about this bit of the theatre being 400 years old, who knows? I'd like to think so, but I suspect it's going to need, it'll sort of look very different to how it is now.
That was John Baldock, General Manager of the Theatre Royal, telling us all about the trials and tribulations of maintaining a 200-plus-year-old building. And staying with theatre and the arts in general, it's time to welcome Kate Arms from the Brighton and Hove Arts Council to the At Home This Morning studio. To get us underway, Kate, please can you tell us what your organisation actually does?
Well, the council's a very small charity that was set up in 1974, I think, to support the not-for-profits sector, art sector, in the local area. So we represent about over 70 groups and individuals, music, dance, spoken word, photography, drama. We publish an arts diary, which is a hard copy and online, so they get listings. And we run a few events as well, one of which I'm going to talk to you about.
So the Brighton and Hove Arts Council is very much a volunteer organisation.
Oh, completely. It's very small scale. It's run by volunteers. And we have a very small grant, which we're very grateful for, from Brighton and Hove Council, which helps us produce the arts diary and supports us. But yes, I think there are only about eight of us. And we're all volunteers, so it's quite a small-scale operation.
But quite a lot to do, I guess.
Yes, we do a lot, and we do as much as we can, but of course, because we're limited numbers, that does limit what we can do. But we run an art exhibition in the spring for the local art groups. We have the drama competition in the autumn. We've had a poetry competition and also last year, for the first time, a poetry festival, which was really successful and headed by no less than Carol Ann Duffy. So that was at the Old Market, and that was really quite a coup. So we're going to do another one of those next year.
And you mentioned then a competition, and you mentioned Oscars.
The Oscars, yes. Well, the drama competition, which runs through the autumn, invites all our local amateur theatre companies to enter a production to be adjudicated by a theatre practitioner. And then we present the Oscars, our equivalent of the Oscars. So they compete, if you like, for best overall production, but also best actor, best actress, best set design, best costume, lots of different ones.
And do you have an Oscar?
We do have trophies. We do have trophies. They are not exactly like the Oscars.
Not a gold statuette.
No, but they are impressive in their own way. I mean, the overall cup is the B. Waters Challenge Cup, and it is a nice big silver trophy.
Gosh. Right. And is this competition open to any group? Or
yes.
But is it drama or musical theatre or anything?
No, it is for drama rather than musical theatre, because when it was set up, it was thought that it was quite difficult to have both in the same competition. So this is very much geared towards drama. So it's either a full-length play or it could be two one-act plays on the same bill.
And how do people get to enter that, or are they nominated?
Well, I sent out lots of emails to as many people as I could find contacts for. Some groups, of course, because they're entering every year, we've got well-established contact links. But with other groups, it's a question of sort of looking online, seeing whether I can find a contact, and then hoping that they respond. But it is open to any amateur drama group who wish to enter a play. Obviously not this year, because we've already got our eight now ready to go.
Oh, right. So the competition is closed for entries this year.
It is for this year, because our first adjudication is actually Friday the 21st of September at Hurstbury Point.
And who are the shortlisted candidates, if you say?
Well, our eight entries are the Hurstbury Point Players, and they're entering Habeas Corpus by Alan Bennett. We've got Burgess Hill Theatre Club with A Steady Rain. The Wick Theatre Company, who are based in Southwick with Plaza Suite. The New Venture Theatre, obviously based in Brighton with Happy Now. Then we've got the Southwick Players, also based in Southwick with The Corn Is Green. Rottingdean Drama Society, Mother Courage, that's a brave choice, isn't it? And Henfield Theatre Company, Brighton Beach Memoirs, another Neil Simon. And finally, we've got a brand new group set up this year, Saints Theatre Group, who are based in Worthing, and they're doing The Ghost Train.
So how do you judge that totally diverse selection?
Well, we have a number of awards, as I said. So, for example, if you're thinking about best set design, the adjudicator will be looking to see how well they've represented the location or the period, how well the set works practically, whether it's atmospheric. And obviously, some plays require much more in the way of set than others, but they have a free choice. So groups will know that if they've chosen something and put it simply in a black box, that perhaps they are not going to be so high up the running order for best set design.
And you go, or people from the Arts Council go along to all these productions?
Yes, we have a professional adjudicator whose name this year is Jane Collins, and she has a very illustrious CV. She's Professor of Theatre and Performance at Wimbledon College of Art with a huge experience in theatre generally. She will see every production, and it will be her decision that gives the awards.
And when do the awards presentation take place?
Tuesday, the 4th of December, at Basvic in the main hall. There will be the most glorious ceremony with lots of pomp and circumstance at which all the awards will be presented.
And is it a black tie event as for the Oscars?
Well, we do try and encourage people to dress up, but no. I mean, you know, we're happy to see them. So if they come in their jeans, of course they'll be, we'll be delighted they'll be there. I think amateur theatre is enormously valuable to any community because it offers a social activity, a creative outlet. I mean, marriages are made in amateur theatre, aren't they? Great lasting friendships. And it covers a huge a spectrum of people as well. I mean, if you want to join in with an orchestra, for example, you've got to be able to play an instrument to a reasonable level. But in amateur theatre, there's room for everyone. So if you are a great actor, brilliant. But if you want to paint the set, or if you want to build something, or you want to do front of house, and it doesn't matter whether you're 16, 18, or 70, or older. So it covers the entire age range. It's a wonderful place for people to mix as well.
So finally, Kate, are the Oscars themselves open to the public?
No, not really, simply because of numbers, because, of course, we invite the amateur companies to send representations, and they usually sort of send between 10 and 20 people. And we do have a limit on space, so they're not open to the public. But all the productions are. So if you would like to come and see any of the productions, which are on between September and November, have a look at the website, which is www.bh-arts.org.uk, and you'll see all the listings there, dates, and also the dates of the adjudications, and you can attend those. So if you wanted to come and see the production and then listen to what the adjudicator has to say, that's open.
Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I was talking to Kate Arms about the Brighton and Hove Arts Council. Now let's hear about the Older People's Festival. And to find out more, I'm handing over the microphone to our executive producer and my colleague, Richard Davis, who's joined by Maxine Thomas.
Maxine, I gather this is the third year that the festival's been running.
That's right. This is the third year. There were previously celebrations of Older People's Day marked on October the 1st, but 3 years ago we decided to make it into a two-week festival. So the festival this year is running from the 24th of September through until the 7th of October.
I know the festivals in the previous years have been very successful. Whose idea was it to run a festival?
I think it was a number of community groups and the Brighton Hove City Council wanting to actually extend what what was delivered on the 1st of October to actually try and really celebrate what older people are able to bring to the city and actually help inspire them to get involved in a range of different activities.
And as we say, October the 1st is the United Nations Older People's Day, is it?
It is, you're right. This year, whilst our festival is running over that period of time, we're working with Brighton Hove City Council, and the focus of this year's celebrations is around ageing well, which is very much what Brighton Hove are hoping to do.
And the last 2 years, you've been able to actually run a special event on October the 1st, haven't you? But this year, October the 1st is a Monday, I think, isn't it?
It is. And so on the 1st of October, we have a number of events going on. There is a mystery event, which is down on outside the theatre and up at Churchill Square. Do come along and find out what this mystery event is. But there are a number of events going on across the whole day as well. Events at the Theatre Royal, we've got Nordic Walking, we have Healthy Lifestyles Teams, so much, too many things to mention.
But in previous years, because it was October the 1st was on the weekend, you were able to run a live day event at the open market. Presumably you can't do that this year.
We can't do that this year, no. So we're trying to change the festival slightly to be more in keeping and provide more opportunities for people. This year we have 111 events across the festival period in 58 different venues. So there should be something for everybody.
So what sort of events are we talking about?
It doesn't really matter what you're interested in. If you're a history buff, if you want to do some exercise, if you like dancing, singing, music, food, there's something in there for everyone.
So some of these are events where you can go along and participate, and others are like concerts, for example, where you go along as a member of the audience.
Right, yes.
But presumably trying to demonstrate all the variety of activities that are available for older people and that older people are already engaged in.
That's right, yes. You know, as I say, a lot of these events are with organisations who deliver different events throughout the year anyway, but by actually bringing them together in this festival, it's actually highlighting what they're able to offer so that people can get involved and actually participate throughout the year. This year we've got some new events coming to the festival. We were very fortunate to be offered some funding by the Chalcliffe Trust, and that's enabled us to purchase two trips out to the wind farm this year. So we've got two boatloads of people going out to on the high seas. Who knows what the days are going to be like at the end of September. But to learn more about the sustainable energy that wind farms are able to offer, and also to actually get up close to those amazing turbines that, you know, sort of you can see from the coast, but you don't really appreciate quite how big they are. But unfortunately, already, those two tours are already full. We have a number of other events that have still got lots of availability, though.
I know that one that I looked at, which I thought might be interesting, was the tour of the sewers, but I gather that's fully booked as well.
That's another one that's fully booked. But again, you know, sort of do get in touch with Southern Water, who run those sewer tours, because they do run them throughout the year. This is just a very special one for us throughout the festival. So, you know, sort of, as I say, a lot of these things are going on throughout the year, but we put them into the festival so that we can just promote them and show people what they can get involved in.
And the same thing applies to the tours to the wind farm, presumably. They are running all the year round.
Absolutely.
If you know who to contact.
Yeah.
No, it certainly looks a big variety of interesting events. And many of them are taster events, aren't they? So that people can try out a particular activity and see whether they'd like to take it any further.
That's right. We were talking earlier about the Nordic Walking taster sessions.
Yes, that's one that looks particularly interesting to me. I don't know what Nordic Walking is, but it sounds interesting.
If you're around by the Brighthelm Gardens, we have put up some images of some of the different groups that are involved in the festival, and Nordic Walking is one of those images that is there. It's a really striking image that really brings to life what people are getting involved in. But we also have Age as a Stage, which is going to be at the Theatre Royal. We have the Food Partnership doing something. We have Singing for Better Health. There's a number of really bright, cheerful images that are there at Brighthelm.
So how do people find out about it?
OK, we've had 4,000 brochures printed, And they've been distributed across the city. They are available in your local library. You can come up to our office at Queen's Road, 19 Queen's Road, or go along to the Hop 50 Plus, which is at Palmyra Square. But I'm sure that you'll be able to find a brochure somewhere, although I have heard they're going like hotcakes too. If you can't get hold of a brochure and you're able to go online, you can look at our website, which shows all of the different events that are available. That's at opf.org.uk. And if you just want to talk to somebody and find out a little bit more about the festival, please give us a call on 01273 322 940.
Right. OK, and now you say us. Who is us?
Us is, good point. Us is Impact Initiatives. We've been coordinating the festival now for the last few years. We're supported by Brighton Hove City Council, and our headline sponsors this year are HomeWise, who have helped us in producing the brochures. We have a small team of people who work incredibly hard to pull this festival together. We're unlike many other festivals. We still have to get on with our day job, but the team work with so many other organisations to who we're really thankful for participating in the festival with us.
When you're not organising this festival, what do Impact Initiatives do?
Impact Initiatives is a community-based charity. We run a range of different projects. No matter what your age, there's probably something that we do that might support you. We run after-school clubs. We run services for young people who are struggling. Adults who with disabilities who may need help to get back to work or may need help having their voices heard. And then we run a number of older people's services too, one at the Hop 50 Plus, which, as I say, is at Palmyra Square. And then we also have a service out in Henfield. All of our services are striving to help people make tomorrow a better day. And this year, Impact celebrates its 40th anniversary as well. So there's a number of events that we're involved in.
All right. Well, congratulations are obviously in order then. Thanks very much for telling us all about that. I shall have to try and get to some of these events.
We look forward to seeing you there. Thank you.
Thank you, Maxine.
Richard Davis was talking there to Maxine Thomas about the forthcoming Older People's Festival for our city. And now for that interview with Michael O'Reilly about the new tour of the hip musical Dirty Dancing that comes to the Theatre Royal later this month. And when I caught up with Michael on the telephone, I first welcomed him to At Home This Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. And how are rehearsals going?
Rehearsals are going great. We're just about to move into tech. And it's good fun, you know. It's great to be doing such an iconic show with such a great team. Yeah, having a really good time.
And tell us, for those that don't know or aren't familiar with the story, what exactly is the story of Dirty Dancing?
So the Dirty Dancing story, it's set in the summer of 1963 at Kellermans. And the story kind of follows a 17-year-old baby who comes to the resort with her family, and it's all about her meeting this guy called Johnny, and they go on a journey together. You know, he teaches her to dance, and you know, the story's all about bravery and people really becoming, you know, who they really want to be. So yeah, the classic story, good fun, lots of amazing high energy numbers. Yeah, it should be good fun for everyone.
And you play the lead. Johnny Castle is the lead, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yeah, very interesting character to play for me.
And a lot of very energetic dancing in there.
Yes, yeah. There's a few really good numbers. Obviously, Johnny and Penny have their classic mambo scene, which has been super, super fun to learn. And then the whole thing finishes with Time of My Life, which is a favourite, so I've heard.
Now, I think Patrick Swayze played the character in the film. So,
yeah.
Are you following that role, or are you making it your own?
Well, it's always really tough to approach a role that's been done before, especially by someone as incredible as Patrick. And I think the way I've tried to approach is to stay as true to Patrick's Johnny as possible. But then, you know, you have to learn how to bring yourself into that character. And all it really is finding, you know, the elements of the character within yourself and then drawing those out. So, yeah, it's been a challenge, you know, but it's great. Great challenge.
Now, I'm sure everybody that's even heard of the title of the show will remember that classic image of the girl, Penny, being lifted above Johnny's shoulders in the middle of a dance. Will you be doing that?
Yes, so we will be doing that, absolutely. Time of My Life comes up right at the very end of the story. Baby is being played by a fantastic actress and dancer, Kira Malou. And, you know, we've been in the rehearsal room already, done the lift a lot of times. And, yeah, it comes right at the end. So it's really good for us to have that as that climactic moment. But it will be in there for everyone who is familiar with the story.
And this is your debut on the professional stage, isn't it? Or is it?
Yes, it is. Graduated from Bird College in July, so this is my first professional gig.
So does that make it harder or easier?
There's an element of it making it harder. Obviously, I guess the more opportunities you get to play roles, the more experienced you become. But I think definitely what I bring by being a graduate is that enthusiasm and that passion. You know, you just want to do the best job possible, really. And, you know, I'm just really determined and excited to do the best performance possible.
What about physical stamina? Because you've got 8 shows a week, something like that?
Yeah, about 8 shows a week, and it's quite a full-on show too.
And so, I mean, you're young, so you've got that side of you as a benefit, but it must be taxing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is quite a tough show. I mean, my background, I come from the rugby pitch, so I grew up with years of playing rugby and playing semi-professionally, and then I just kind of stumbled into the dance industry, you know, and I think that's really helpful to come from that background, because you already have that stamina and you have that training regime that's in place, and, you know, it's kind of like the foundation that you keep coming back to. So that's really helped me with this role especially.
Now, of course, the show launches just about the time that Strictly Come Dancing launches on BBC television on the Saturday night.
Yeah, it does. Amazing.
Are there parallels to that, do you think? I mean, how similar is dance on stage to the dancing you see on television?
Well, I think Strictly Come Dancing is great for our industry, you know, because the dancers that you see on there are the highest level professionals. They are really, really great dancers and choreographers. And the exciting thing with Dirty Dancing is it's a very similar style. You know, you have all those ballroom elements that are underlying. And then on top of that, you have the Dirty Dancing too, which is obviously because the story's set in 1963. You have that like new, exciting, dirtier element. But there are definitely going to be a lot of recognizable steps in there for fans of Strictly Come Dancing, for sure.
And would you like to do that yourself? Would you like to be one of the professionals one day on Strictly?
Yeah, I mean, Strictly Come Dancing is a great show. Whether being a professional dancer on there, being a guest on there, either way would be a really fun experience. I know my friends and family watch the show a lot, so that'd be really exciting for them to see.
And talking about your friends and family, will they be in the audience at the Theatre Royal in Brighton?
They will, yeah. They're all coming down to support on the 20th for opening night, which will be lovely.
And if you had to pick a hit number from the show for you, not necessarily from the audience, what would it be?
Oh, that's a good question. There are a few good ones in the show. For me personally, I really enjoy Still of the Night. We have Alex, who's playing Billy, and he just has the most incredible voice, and he just that song comes at a really important time in the show for Johnny, and it's a really emotional point, and really enjoy that number in there.
And of course, Time of My Life as you say, it comes to the end of towards the end of the show.
Well, Time of My Life's just the most amazing number. You know, it finishes the show. Everyone's on high energy. The audience, you know, they're really gonna be familiar with that part. You know, if they're familiar with the show, familiar with the film, big climactic moment finishes with everyone on stage singing and dancing. Great, yeah, really good fun.
We look forward to coming and seeing you during the show run in Brighton, and good luck, and thanks very much for joining us, Michael.
No, thank you very much for having me. Been a pleasure.
I was talking there to Michael O'Reilly, who stars in the musical Dirty Dancing that will be on at the Theatre Royal from Thursday the 20th to Saturday the 29th of September. And that's just about it from me, Chris English, and this edition of At Home This Morning. So until we meet next over the airwaves in a few weeks' time, it's just time for me to repeat all those important contact details. For information on Steve Sparks and Mike Dawson's amazing adventures across the Pacific Ocean, simply enter Cockleshell Pacific Endeavour into Google or whatever search engine you use. And you can also find them on Facebook under the same title. For further details of the Brighton Hove Arts Council, their full web address is www.bh-arts.org.uk. If you'd like more information on the forthcoming Older People's Festival, their website is www.opf.org.uk. And for tickets to see Dirty Dancing at the Theatre Royal Brighton, just go to www.atgtickets.com. Or if you go to the box office in New Road, Brighton in person, you avoid the dreaded booking fee. But now it's time for me, Chris English, to thank you for listening to this edition of At Home This Morning, which is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb. And to again thank my executive producer, Richard Davis, and Sarah Elgrew for producing the programme and all the technical matters. And, of course, Richard's interview with Maxine Thomas from the Older People's Festival. But my final thanks must go to you for letting me join you wherever you may be. And so, until we meet again over the airwaves, whatever you do, keep safe.
At Home This Morning is a Grey Matters production for Radio Reverb.